Okay, so let's get started. Might go for just an hour today.
Friday,
and it's nice out, believe it or not. Amazing, and yeah, I know, it's like a different country, isn't it? it's probably, this is it, though, for like the next few months, so.
You had to do this.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, so we're on the Huayan. Chapter 7, and so last time we talked a bit about sort of the introduction of Huayan to China from India, and the main source of Huayan is a Buddhist sutra in Chinese called the Huayan Jing, and in Sanskrit it's called the Avatamsaka. And I talked about at some length how the final sort of chapter of this Avatamsaka is a text in Sanskrit called the Gandavyuha Sutra, which I translate as the Supreme Array. And this is the longest and most important, you could argue, but I think it is longest and most important and concluding chapter of the Avatamsaka Sutra. And since I've studied the Gandavyuha for 20 years and written numerous articles and a book about it, I talked about it at some length last time, particularly in relation to the worldview that you find in this Gandavyuha, which is the Mahayana Sutra, this very expansive worldview of interpenetration of all time and space. And I talked in specifically about this idea of the Dharma Dhatu, or the reality realm, which is the sutra's vision of what the highest reality is. I also talked at some length how this Avatamsaka and the Gandavyuha, it's more about showing rather than telling, in the sense that it describes this infinitely vast cosmos where all time and space interpenetrates. It's very visionary. There's infinite Buddhas everywhere, and all these pure Buddha lands that are made out of jeweled and gems and gold and stuff. But it doesn't really explain how this is possible. Like, doesn't give a philosophical account. So it was sort of up to the Huayan philosophers to come up with one. And in doing so, basically what they're trying to do is explain how this vision of reality could work, how it could be possible, how it all fits together. And by doing that, they were making something that was very Indian into something that was Chinese. And one of the ways that they did that is they came up with particular models and also metaphors. Now in the Gandavyuha, for example, we see metaphors that are used, particularly for this Dharma Dhatu. Two very common ones are bodies and buildings. So they'll describe, for example, there's a tower that belongs to the future Buddha, Maitreya. And inside the tower, there's infinite other towers, all similar, all made out of jewels and gems, all interreflecting each other, so that every part of every tower is reflected in every other part of every other tower, sort of on forever. And so what you're seeing there is a building is being used as a metaphor to represent reality, right? Hi. So the Huayan masters like to use their own metaphors, and last time we talked about a few of those. For anybody who's read the chapter or was here last time, what were At least, well, what was one of those metaphors that was used anyway to explain reality of, that's found in the Huayan Jing? Nobody wants to take a stab at it? Okay. One of them.
You use the mirror and the candle one? You mean that one?
Yeah, okay. Yep, that will work. That will work. One of the examples, the most important Huayan master is this guy, Futsung. And he was the personal sort of tutor and counselor of Empress Wu. And there's a number of famous accounts of Empress Wu asking Futsung about the reality according to Huayan teachings. And a very famous example that he uses to illustrate this is that he leads her to an octagonal room, and there's mirrors on all the sides and the ceiling and the floor. And he puts a golden Buddha statue in the middle of it and a torch. And so that Buddha is reflected in all the mirrors. And so he uses this mirrored room as a metaphor for the Dharma Dhatu, or this highest level of reality. So call that mirrored room or hall of mirrors or whatever. Okay, now another one that he used was the golden lion. Right? He says he uses he's looking for a way to illustrate the reality of the Huayan Jing, and they're walking in the palace and he sees a statue of a golden lion, so he uses that as an example. Which relates to, we should mention one of the models now, probably, and that is this idea of Li and Sher, or principle and phenomena. Sometimes Li is referred to as a noumenon. That's a term that's borrowed from the philosopher Kant to represent sort of reality in and of itself, in its own nature, like kind of goes beyond appearance. And so Li is this principle that goes beyond all appearance, the ultimate sort of foundation of reality, kind of groundless ground, if you will. And Sher are the phenomena that appear. And so in the example of the golden lion, he ends up actually writing a treatise called The Treatise on the Golden Lion, where he uses it to summarize the basic teachings of the Huayan school. And so here, for example, he explains the principle of dependent arising according to the golden lion. He says, this is to say that gold has no inherent nature of its own, no svabhava. It is owing to the artistry of the skillful craftsman that the form of the lion arises. This arising is the result solely of the cause conditioning. Therefore, it is called the arising through dependent arising. So, and then he goes on to explain other models such as, or concepts in Huayan, such as emptiness, the ten mysteries, perfect wisdom, nirvana. And so the idea here that we see is that the noumenon here is represented by the gold of the golden lion. So it doesn't matter what you do with gold, it's still gold, right? So you can make it in any shape you want, it's still going to be gold. Now, whatever shape that you make it into, that is the sure, that is the phenomena. So in the case of the gold lion, its principle is gold. But the phenomena are all the various parts of the lion. So its mane, its tail, its legs, its body, that kind of thing. So there was one other one that we talked about. just briefly, which I want to talk more about, and that is what's called the jeweled net of Indra. And the jeweled net of Indra is described as this infinite net, and at the intersection of the different strands, there are gems, and those gems interreflect with all the other gems, so that in each gem, all the other gems are reflected. Right? And so, similar to the tower of Maitreya, where there's infinite other interreflecting towers, you find that the jeweled net also represents this type of reality. Now, last time we talked about emptiness, so which is a kind of crucial, it's sort of like a golden key, really, in a lot of ways, to understanding, I mean, not only Huayan, but also Chan and Zen in many ways. So maybe just briefly, if somebody, I gave a very sort of succinct, brief definition of what Buddhist emptiness is. Can anybody recall what that might be? Bradford. Quick, look at your notes. I'm going to have to wing it then. Do you remember emptiness, Buddhist emptiness? It means empty of something in particular.
Is it the thing to do with independent existence?
Yes, right? Exactly. So emptiness means empty of inherent existence. You can say empty of inherent existence. And so these are technical terms, right? So emptiness is shunyata. Inherent existence is svabhava, which literally means own nature. We can also translate it as essence. We could add to this a little bit, and we could say that emptiness means all, let's do it down here, all things are empty of inherent existence. And here the term for things is another technical term, dharmas, which can mean, you can translate as elements, or factors, or just as I did, just things, or phenomena, right? Anything that can appear within awareness is some type or other of a dharma. So they're like psychophysical entities, right? And so basically what emptiness is saying is that anything that you can perceive only exists in dependence on every other thing. It doesn't exist independently. It doesn't have a core or a separate essence, right? And so because of that emptiness, all things are interdependent. And so all this talk about interdependence and dependent arising, that's another really important Buddhist idea, this idea of dependent arising. And when we get to the philosopher Nagarjuna from India, who's the founder of the Madhyamaka school, right? He was the one for the first time that actually equated emptiness with dependent arising. So he basically said that they're just two different ways of saying the same thing. And another thing that we talked about last time is that emptiness is, in a sense, is an extension of this whole idea of Buddhist no self, right? Because we talked about how in Buddhism, right back from the time of the Buddha, this idea that no one has a soul, right? No one has a part of them that's eternal and unchanging, that gets reincarnated again and again and again. It's just that we're just aggregations of different forces that come together, last for a while, and die, and then there's this kind of karmic energy or momentum that continues as the residual seeds of our karma that then will take on a new form, and it keeps going on like that. But they're just like a car doesn't have a soul, like a car-ness to it, neither does the person, and then by extension, neither do any of these dharmas or anything else. Because initially, after the time of the Buddha, the earliest Buddhist philosophers developed this theory. They're called, the philosophy is called Abhidharma, the higher dharma, higher teaching, that like medium-sized dry goods like tables and chairs and people and things like that, they don't have an essence. But dharmas, these elements, the basic building blocks of experience, they're real. They're actually real. It's kind of an atomic theory of existence, that phenomena in their blinking in and out of existence quite rapidly, right? So every like sensory perception that we have, whether I'm looking this way or that way, or every physical sensation I have of hardness or softness or whatever, those are all made up of these, you know, factors that are blinking in and out quite rapidly, but they exist. But then when Mahayana comes along, and this guy Nagarjuna, he says that no, in fact, even those things down here only have dependent existence on other things. Okay, so that's the kind of philosophical background for a whole bunch of other ideas that come out in Huayan philosophy. Does that make sense to people? I think now might be a good time to pause for a second. Because if you're not on board with what I've covered so far, nothing I say after this point on this topic is going to make any sense.
So, essentially that's like saying that nothing has any inherent like meaning or like existence in itself. And so every like the reality outside of what we live in is all of
That would be, yeah, I think so. That would be a fair assessment. Because what happens is when you realize that, like, that things are, the other background to this, if we recall, the other major stream of Mahayana philosophy in India before it came to China was the idea of mind only, which is the notion that really, ultimately, really, there's only consciousness. And so things that appear only exist because they are dependent upon consciousness for their existence. And so that, combined with this idea of emptiness, basically means, yeah, that the things that we experience in the world, including ourselves, have only a kind of quasi or sort of dreamlike status to them. They don't exist outside of that consciousness that's experiencing them. It's not that they're completely unreal. This is important to get too. It's not that they're completely unreal, but it's not that they're completely real either. They're kind of somewhere in between, just like a dream, right? Because a dream is like, you know, you said, oh, I had a scary dream last night. And I'll be like, no, you didn't. You know, there's no such thing as dreams, right? You wouldn't say that, right? It doesn't make any sense. But you wouldn't say that, you know, the scary monster that, you know, chewed your legs off in the dream is real. But it's real as far as like being a dream, like a dream entity. In that sense, it was real. So our everyday ordinary reality has a kind of relative or conventional reality to it, but not an ultimate reality to it. Now, what is the ultimate reality of things? We talked a little bit about this before, right? Emptiness doesn't mean that there is this real void of nothingness, and that's what's that really exists. From a strict kind of Madhyamaka point of view, from Nagarjuna's teaching, it means basically that 42 to 845, Huayan philosophy continued to exert an influence in Chinese thought, especially in the later developments of Chan, to which we now turn. Chan being the Chinese name for Zen. Okay, so next time we will discuss Chan. I was